You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel, we're your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jared Dubin of Last Night in Basketball, and with less than a week before the trade deadline, a lot of interesting threads to discuss, both on the season itself and what we're looking for the trade deadline, the implications of Zach LaVine's injury, plenty more stuff. Episode is brought to you by FanDuel, FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins. So you can check that out. This episode's a little shorter than usual, in part because of timing constraints on my end, but still lots of great stuff in here. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man. It's always a good time.
We are less than a week before the trade deadline, and while that doesn't need to be all that we discuss, it, of course, is a significant factor in the league right now. And I think the place I want to start with you on that is, do you think we will see anything more significant for, let's say, the arc of the league this year than the Anunoby and Siakam trades that have already happened?
That's an interesting question. I guess it depends on what you consider significant to the arc of the league, because I think, like, there's been strong reporting out there that the Bucks are going to try to do something. And insofar as they're, like, second in the East, then obviously they have Giannis. Any move they make seems like it might be more significant than something like Siakam to Indiana, if that makes sense. And then, you know, Oklahoma City obviously is in position to buy if they want to. There's been signals out that Minnesota wants to buy, like, a backup point guard. The Knicks obviously have been in rumors involved for, you know, backup guards or wings or things like that. So I don't know if anybody that changes teams will have as big an impact on their team as Anunoby seems to have had on New York so far. But there are obviously teams at or near the top of their conference that are trying to do something. So in that sense, it could be more significant. I'm curious how you feel about that.
It makes sense to me. And the other one that I'll throw in there, I don't expect to see the landscape shaping move from them, but I've really wondered how Daryl Morey is seeing what has happened over the last month. Mm-hmm. And because basically I wrote this whole thing for The Athletic about, like, the Sixers being the most interesting team in the 24 offseason. And part of that was because they were a very successful team, of course, less so now that Joel's, you know, dealing with this meniscus issue. But they also had true max cap space. Like, they could get to a 30% max without too much difficulty, and there isn't a 35% guy, especially now that Kawhi is extended. And so I had this idea of, like, oh, they're the sleeping giant. They're the team that would keep everybody with bird rights up at night, is like, and the team that I focused on, and that was Toronto, where it was like, okay, you know, if you're thinking you're going to re-sign Siakam, you're thinking you're going to re-sign Anunoby, the Sixers can offer very similar money for 4 years, and potentially they, you know, and they're a better team and all that type of stuff. And now, and so Morey at the, you know, then and now, it's weighing cap space versus making moves now. And the benefit of cap space is that there are a lot of options open to you, not just free agents, but you could trade for players and everything else, and you can do it in an imbalanced way. But the benefit of going over, which we've seen with the Pacers, is that it's easier to retain your own talent. And so for, like, the DeAnthony Melton part of this, or even potentially Tobias Harris if he's not matching salary, the Sixers can probably have a better team in 24-25 if they could acquire that player. Now, the problem for them is, now that those two guys are traded, and now that Kawhi Leonard resigned, who is that guy either in free agency or in a trade? And I think it's just more likely that they wait because it's not sure who that is.
Yeah, I don't know who would be in a trade right now. Obviously, people peg them as possibly a Zach LaVine team, but I didn't really think that was realistic to begin with. And then now, you know, he's getting that surgery on his foot. The guy in free agency, I guess, it's still hanging out there, is Paul George. Obviously, has not extended with the Clippers as of yet. I don't think it's going to be James Harden, obviously. But, you know, PG didn't say that, like, he guaranteed he was going to sign with the Clippers this offseason. I think it's pretty much thought that he will or assumed that he will. But, you know, you never know the way things turn out. If he hasn't extended by, you know, the playoffs, it's possible that something could go wrong for them in the postseason. And then he decides that he wants to get out of there for some reason or another. This is obviously all speculation and no way sourced or reporting or anything like that. It's just like thinking about the different guys that could possibly be on the board. But the big thing for them in these next few days is, like, is Daryl trying to, like, salvage this season, or is he trying to build for the future around a potentially healthy Embiid and Tyrese Maxey? Like, what does he feel about whether or not Embiid can actually play the rest of this season? Because that's the thing that determines more than anything else what path they're going to take in the next few days, because I think it determines what targets they're interested in. Right? Like, it has to.
It has to. And it makes me think back to something our mutual friend Sam Vecenie and I talked about a few weeks ago. I believe that was on his podcast about how, or no, it was Matt Moore, how one of the surprising things about the Sixers season is how a lot of us came into it with, like, low expectations. We worried about the risks of this year and, like, oh, teams like the Knicks are circling Joel Embiid. Well, now the Embiid, Maxey, and the Sixers have a pretty good idea that when they're healthy, this can work. Like, they have proof of concept here. But we don't know if that proof of concept is going to bear out for the 23-24 season, or more importantly, the postseason. And so that means, presumably, they're going to keep it together in that form. But it does change the way that the front office thinks about not only the summer, but also, as you said, the remainder of this year, where how hard do you go after it? What is it looking like? And for Embiid, unfortunately, it's how long will it take for him to recover, and what kind of a post-recovery is that? Is it something where if he doesn't have surgery, you're going to be waiting, you know, like any recurrence, and then you go back down? Or is it like it can get to a point where it's almost as stable as it was before? And I don't know. I don't know his knee. I don't know any of these details. But to me, if Embiid can't be right/trusted this year, like, let's, I'm not saying this is the difference, I'm not a knee expert, but if the difference is he can play, but you can't trust it without surgery, knowing what I know, would just do the surgery and just say this year is not as important as next year. But I'm not the one who's in charge of this.
Yeah, I unfortunately am quite familiar with meniscus injuries and surgeries and decisions to either get or not get surgery. But interestingly, the meniscal flap tear or injury or whatever they're calling it is, like, the one thing that I didn't do to the meniscus in my knee. So I don't know necessarily the difference there. A lot of it depends on, like, the location and size of the tear and whether you get it partially removed or like they used to do, like, you know, full removals, just like, hey, you're bone on bone for the rest of your life, which is what I have, unfortunately, on both sides of my left knee. You know, I had the medial meniscus and the lateral meniscus both torn, and they took out a piece of the medial meniscus and all of the lateral meniscus, which is why I'm in so much discomfort all the time. But sucks. Yeah, no, I mean, like, I can operate day to day as a normal person. Could I play NBA basketball? Even if I was talented enough, probably not. So I don't know necessarily what obviously the specifics of his knee look like, but there are different options, and depending on where it is, they could even go for repair, and that's a significantly longer recovery. That's, you know, usually measured in, you know, 4 to 6 months, as opposed to, you know, if you do a removal, that you could be ready in as little as, like, a month, basically.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how your rehab goes.
It sounds like they're even considering non-surgical options for this, which is interesting for me. I don't know exactly how that.
Yeah, I tried that the first time I tore my meniscus, but because it was only partially torn, and I then injured myself while rehabbing and fully tore it, which was what led to the surgery. There are situations where you can rehab it and strengthen it enough to where it's not necessarily 100%, but like new, basically. Like you buy something online and it says like new. There are situations where you can get away with that. That's what I did when I tore my hip when I was rehabbing. I tore the opposite hip and I didn't get surgery on that. I just rehabbed and got it back to basically like new condition. It's a path that you try to take if you think you can get away with it, but there are times where it just doesn't work out and you wind up having to get the surgery anyway. For example, this is total speculation, but I think that's what the Knicks might be doing with Julius Randle's shoulder right now.
Trying to get away with
not having surgery and seeing how it heals over these next 2-3 weeks or so.
It does seem like that's the way it goes. And yeah, I mean, I don't think there's as much that we can get on the Sixers thread. So let's finish out. So I don't know. You brought up I don't know who they would trade for. I agree with you on that. And they have some resources. They would theoretically have more in the summer just based on the passage of time opens up draft picks and various other things. But I don't even know who necessarily they're targeting at this point, especially considering it looked not definitively, not binding, but it looks like Anunoby and Siakam will probably stay where they are now. And so, there aren't that many strong players left, and it's not really that kind of market. And there are some like Drew Holiday that could conceptually be a fit. And of course, he has familiarity with Philly, but he's also on a really good team right now. And there are plenty of reasons for Boston to want to retain him, even if Drew Holiday's offensive game hasn't been quite what they hoped for. And the challenge of the trade route, let's say it's somebody who's under contract for 24-25 and beyond, ideally, is that then you have another party you have to negotiate with. And that party has, even if you can do them more of a favor, like, for example, if a team that is looking to offload salary has a good player, there are benefits to them of doing a deal with Philly as opposed to somebody cobbling together mediocre matching salary somewhere else. But you have to give up assets in that sort of deal, because any player that's worth getting is going to be worth assets.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't even know who that would be. Is the best guy out there for them that makes the most sense for them, is that DeMar DeRozan, right? And I don't know how much that really changes their life.
I mean, theoretically, they could be. I mean, I don't know that anyone involved really wants it, but they could be a Donovan Mitchell destination if he decides he doesn't want to be in Cleveland anymore this summer.
I meant in the next three days.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very challenging, and they could do something in the mock deadline. They ended up getting Josh Giddey, which was a fascinating concept, where basically get a player who has a low enough cap hold, who doesn't change the arc too much. You could use some resources to get that, but those are hard to find. Those are tricky. And, even finding a player like that who's workable. And yeah, and especially there are definitely players, we don't know who they are, who will open up in the summer, especially if they know Philly is available, but they're probably not going to do that now. For example, even if Lauri Markkanen decided he would rather be in Philadelphia than in Utah and the Jazz aren't super competitive, it just doesn't seem like a move that would happen right now.
Yeah, especially not because the Jazz have been playing well. I mean, I know that recently not quite as well as maybe 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, when they went on that 15-4 run or whatever it was.
Right. And, they've been much better in the last month than they had been earlier in the season when they had a million guys out. And I think if the let me bring it up. Yeah, I mean, if the season ended right now as we're having this conversation, potentially changing depending on what happens in both the Rockets and Jazz games later tonight, the Jazz would be in the play-in at least. So, that doesn't necessarily look like a situation where they just say, all right, we're pulling the plug. We're trading Lauri Markkanen right now. That doesn't seem to be the situation that they're in.
Exactly. So
I also think even if the Sixers wanted that, there are just so many teams that could outbid them for a guy like that.
And if anyone's going to open the bidding on a player, it's going to be Danny Ainge. That's just the way he does things. He's not going to just take a single offer unless it's just comically good for him, which there have been times when, of course, it has been. But I don't expect It feels like a Maury Ainge negotiation would be pulling teeth rather than the Ainge Billy King negotiation that led to the basically the forming of Boston's current core. And so I agree with you. I think that Philly, it has gotten to be a significantly tougher spot because there just aren't that many suitable players left. I don't know if they were big Siakam people or big Anunoby people in the first place. Like, it may be that those weren't the targets, but there just aren't that many. And I don't know if they were that interested in Kawhi. It seemed to me like no one was thinking Kawhi was truly available this summer. And he, of course, now actually isn't available because he signed the extension. We'll see if Paul George joins him or does not. I would assume that James Harden probably not going back for logical reasons. Plenty more to discuss, but first a message from FanDuel. Happy Super Bowl to all who celebrate from FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. If you're like me, Super Bowl Sunday is all about scoring the best seat on the couch, grabbing your favorite football snacks, and placing some super bets. Especially for me, as someone who grew up in the Bay Area, who is a 49ers fan, I'm extremely excited about that. And of course, there are a lot of great player props. And I don't know if I'm more optimistic or realistic, but I'd love for the Niners to do well. And of course, there's always the fun. You can bet on the length of the national anthem and all sorts of other great stuff. FanDuel has so many ways for you to end the season with a W or two or three. Not only can you bet on who will win Super Bowl 58, but FanDuel also has bets for which players will score a touchdown, how many points will be scored, and so much more. New customers join today and you'll get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins. Just visit FanDuel.com/Boston to sign up. That's FanDuel.com/Boston. Make every moment more with FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or over and present in select states. FanDuel is offering sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as a non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 533-42 in Arizona, 1-888-789-777 or ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700 or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York. So let's go to the Knicks. I mean, the team that you are geographically closest to, they have been on an absolute tear in the month of January. How much of that for you is sustainable?
You know, to the extent that they're going to be 15-3, like, mm-hmm. Nobody plays that well, you know, unless you're going to win 70 games, right? Like 15-3, that's, I guess you would get to 60-12. So that's like a 65, 66 win pace for the season or something along those lines. I don't think that they're that good. I do think that they are a team that just makes much more sense now when, at least when they're healthy, because the way that Anunoby fits with Randall and Brunson just makes so much more sense than the way RJ Barrett did. I think you saw yesterday against the Lakers that they have, you know, a pretty big issue with the lack of secondary ball handlers right now, which is why the names that you hear them connected to on the trade market is like, you know, Malcolm Brogdon, Jordan Clarkson, Bruce Brown, those kind of guys, you know, sort of like the backup point guard that can possibly play with Brunson types. That's the thing that this year's version of the team needs. And I think, you know, Fred Katz has talked about this a bunch. The ideal scenario for them would be to get that guy that is still under contract next year at a sizable enough number that if they wanted to make their long-awaited superstar trade this summer, they could put him in that trade and he would be considered, you know, at least a neutral or better asset, so they don't have to dip into, you know, trading like Mitchell Robinson or Josh Hart or Dante DiVincenzo or one of those guys that's, you know, in their rotation that seems to be part of their core group of guys. I think that, you know, for that reason, to me, Brogdon and Brown make the most sense because they're both, you know, are making over $20 million. Both are guys that you could play in the role that you need them to play over these next few months and could also potentially be guys that you even keep around if you can't make that deal this summer. That's sort of where I'm at in terms of their options. But, you know, as far as what's sustainable, like the way Anunoby has changed both their offense and their defense, and I think the way specifically Hartenstein in for Mitchell Robinson has opened things up offensively for them. They just access so many different areas of the floor with that group out there than they did when Mitch was the guy that was involved in all their screens and dribble handoffs. Just Hartenstein is a more well-rounded offensive player in terms of his ability to do like dribble handoffs and to make passes from the elbow and things like that. I think it opened things up for them a little bit more offensively, but their ceiling defensively, I think, is higher with Robinson. And obviously, if he gets back, that would help them significantly because they could, you know, have 48 minutes of those guys as opposed to whatever it is with Hartenstein, and then, you know, whatever you get out of Precious Achiuwa. They're sustainably very good. I don't know how 15-3 sustainable they are.
I'm really happy you brought up Hartenstein's impact on the offense. It's something that I've really noticed watching the Knicks over the last little while, is just that it gives them a little bit more fluidity, which is important. And when you think about New York as a potential playoff team and the ways that other teams can come up the works, and that doesn't mean I'm saying definitively Hartenstein should start over Mitchell Robinson, they should trade Mitchell Robinson, anything like that. It's just, it's nice to have a different angle. And I understand why Thibodeau was in the early stretch was very reluctant to move Hartenstein off of the second unit, you know, like to keep the second unit, because having his playmaking is very useful with their bench lineups, but it opens things up with their starters too. So there'll be some balancing to do there if and when Mitchell Robinson returns, whether that's this year or not. We know that they applied and were rejected for the disabled player exception, which was weird for a variety of different reasons. And for Anunoby, it has been such an impressive, such a seamless fit. I think defensively, that's going to make sense to a lot of people. Do you want to shed some light on why you think it's been such a good offensive fit?
Yeah, I mean, the best way I could do it is suggest that people go read Chris Herring's story on it at ESPN. He, you know, I think did a great job of explaining exactly why it's worked so well. And it was basically the theory that people had exactly when the Knicks made the trade, which is like it essentially has like democratized their offense, where they no longer have like a third guy who needs the ball all the time to be his best self. And the ball, for the most part, is with Brunson and Randall and everybody else. Their roles sort of fit in line, and they move around better, and they move around more often. Their assist rate is up significantly since they made that move, because there's more cutting and there's more passing. And Anunoby is obviously, you know, like a better shooter, and is more willing to both play and move without the ball. And the way he's been able to capitalize on the ways that Brunson and Randall bend the defense in their direction, and then with the way he's been able to capitalize on, you know, the way that DiVincenzo can bend the defense with his shooting, and the way both of them have spaced the floor for Brunson and Randall, and the way Hartenstein has opened things up because he's able to operate further from the rim, it just makes everything flow much more seamlessly than it did when they had, you know, another guy who was more of a, you know, straight line downhill attacker who defenses helped off of when he was in the corner or on the wing, and who, you know, was best with the ball in his hands. It just makes things click in much more seamlessly.
There are some truly jaw-dropping numbers, acknowledging the small sample size here of some of the Knicks combinations when you include Anunoby, which means it's the stretch where they've been molten hot overall. So Brunson, Randall, Anunoby on the floor. 582 clean the glass positions, so not that many. Plus 26 net rating, which is astonishing. And then you're like, well, what about Brunson and Anunoby? No Randall. Like, now we're down to 152, plus 45.7 net rating. And then just Anunoby and Brunson, plus 30 in 734 possessions. So that is ridiculous. That is not the type of thing that you necessarily expect to sustain. But what you brought up in terms of democratizing the offense and the way that it can flow, It is a structure that allows you to not only use a non-shooting center, which they are basically all the time with Hart. Now, Achiuwa, you know, at times has had visions of being a shooting center, though that hasn't typically materialized. But then also, like, you don't need players like DiVincenzo or Josh Hart to do quite as much, and that, but they can, and that's not to say that
except when Randall and Anunoby are both out, and sure, you apparently need Achiuwa Kuzmanovua to play 44 minutes a night, and DiVincenzo and Brunson to play the entire second half. Like, they played five guys 80 minutes in 3 days.
Incredible. And that's a part of why they I only watched a portion of the game, but they seemed tired during the game against the Lakers on Saturday.
Oh, I mean, they went like 6 full minutes without scoring in the fourth quarter because they were all completely gassed, and finally someone decided, like, hey, we're literally just not going to let Jalen Brunson shoot. We don't care what else happens. Like, somebody else is going to have to do something, and they just couldn't do it for like 6 minutes. I would expect that the reason Evan Fournier hasn't played in these last four games where they've been without both Randall and Ananobi is because they expect to get something done with him in these next 4 days, and they don't want him to get hurt and potentially derail it. But that's just me sort of, you know, assuming logical coaching, which isn't always the case.
Not always. And I mean, until the last game against the Lakers, like, there is this weird thing, like, they kept on winning. And so a coach is like, where you a coach will lean on a lineup, will lean on a player until it doesn't work, and then they'll reassess. Like, there's, it's the old, like...
Right. Well, at least they had Quentin Grimes for the previous games. So they were playing at least 8 guys.
Yeah.
Yesterday, they were playing like 6.5 guys.
They were. And I agree with you on the logic with Fournier. I think that, and you brought it up before, and it bears some emphasis that the goal with Fournier's potentially expiring contract is to get a player who has a 24-25 element that is significantly better than the team option they have on Fournier. Because, like, the problem with the team option that is overvalued is the most likely outcome is you just decline it and then it's done. And in a less extreme version than, like, what the Clippers were dealing with Eric Gordon, because in that case, that just added so much to their tax bill, the Knicks aren't really going to actually sacrifice that much financially. It'll, you know, cost Dolan money, but probably not tax stuff to keep somebody around. And so but the goal is, it's not only who can help you now. Like, I mean, I think that all the guys you mentioned, Brunson, and I mean, I've thought of them as a potential D'Angelo Russell destination, but the challenge with him is he has a player option. And so with the player option, you have to assume that the player is going to make the correct decision. And so that means that if he picks up the option, he's not worth it. And if he declines the option, then you probably don't want to then he's going to make more money and might lead to other challenges. So,
yeah, I think the bigger issue with them and D'Angelo Russell is that you're counting on Thibodeau to play him. And I do not see that marriage of skill set and personality and whatnot going all that well.
Not all that well, but with the concept with Russell that could be valuable for the Knicks is getting somebody who Tibbs trusts less, so he mainly uses him as a Brunson backup. Like, that they need somebody who can do that now, in my opinion. Like, even though they've gotten a little bit more supplemental creation from some of the guys on their bench, I think they could have that. The challenge is that I don't think Tibbs would trust him to do anything more than that, whereas somebody like Brunson, that becomes significantly more plausible, palatable, as long as he's healthy.
Somebody like Brogdon, you mean?
Brogdon, sorry.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Different BN, but...
Yeah. I was just trying to figure out where you were going with that. Yeah. I was like, wait, somebody like Brunson? Yeah.
Brunson.
I think that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, those are the guys, I think that's the pool they're sort of treading in. Obviously, they've also been connected to guys like Clarkson and Alec Burks. The issue with Burks is that he's expiring and they don't get that 24-25 element that they could put him in a trade. And the issue with Clarkson is this year he's on a balloon payment and salary goes way down next year, and it makes it more difficult to match things in a trade. Plus, you have the element of, like, is Tibbs going to play Clarkson, which I don't think you would necessarily have with someone like Brogdon or someone like Brown.
It's a great point, and something that Leon Rose is going to have to navigate for the remainder, for this deadline and kind of how they want to piece together. And I'm sure another consideration is, are those teams going to be demanding assets? But I don't think that most of them have the leverage to get something significant, in part because of the volume. Now, maybe that leads to Danny Ainge just keeping Jordan Clarkson. Sure, that's not a problem. And then Brogdon, I mean, the Blazers have done a lot of posturing, and we're going to find out much more clearly at this deadline whether that is real or that is not. If both Jeremy Grant and Malcolm Brogdon are on the Blazers a week from now, I will I'm not going to say well played because I don't think that's what they should do, but I will be like, I will believe you a lot more when you say these things moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, he did draw the line in the sand and then not actually trade Dame to Miami. So there is at least some track record of I'm not doing this and then him not doing that.
But he also got the return that he was looking for from someone else
right. Eventually.
So the other kind of main topic that I wanted to discuss with you, and this is something Nate and I probably aren't going to have the time to do before the deadline, is how some of these teams more on the margins are self-evaluating, because that's another huge factor in the way that the deadline actually shakes out. And it's always worth emphasizing that the way the people involved evaluate it and the way you and I evaluate it are often not the same. And that is because they're
so looking, basically you want to talk about the Bulls.
Well, the Bulls are one of them, but I mean another one that is just as if not more interesting to me is the Warriors, where the Warriors have there are certain elements of their decision making over the next 6 months that are going to kind of be there either way. And like one big part of that is like what in the world they end up doing with Klay Thompson after this year. But for example, they will have decisions to make with Andrew Wiggins, who is under contract at what would be reasonable terms if he didn't play horrendously for the entire year like he has pretty much so far. But also this huge question mark that is Chris Paul's salary for next year. And just, I don't want to dwell too much on it, but Chris Paul, flat $30 million non-guarantee for next year. Not a team option, a non-guarantee, and that distinction could matter a lot here. Because what
is that a full non-guarantee?
It is a full non-guarantee. So what that means is, sort of like his former teammate Eric Gordon, the Warriors could retain Chris Paul to keep him. That is, of course, an option. They could basically guarantee his contract and then either keep him or use him as ballast in a trade, which would be a lot, very, very expensive for them. Or, if assuming he makes it through the end of the year on the roster, they could just decline that. And reminder that if you cut a non-guaranteed player, then it does make it a little bit harder to retain them. You know, like you have to use another exception. You don't just be like, oh, if he doesn't get claimed, you get full bird rights, everything's all good. Like, that's not the way this works.
Yeah, it's they got a lot of decisions to make. None of them are easy, I don't think. Like, yeah, the Klay Thompson.
Almost like the person who used to run the team deciding not to run the team anymore made a reasonable choice for his, like, I'm not saying this is why Bob did it, I don't know, for his mental health. Like, the idea of, like, the rest of this is going to be hard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it's complicated. What are there? There's 2 years left for Steph after this year.
Correct.
Right? And it seems like, other than Draymond, when he's being himself, their next best guys are like all rookies and Kuminga. And that's like a really complicated thing to untangle when you have 2 years left of a guy who looks like he still should be able to drive like really high level winning, but like 75-80% of their cap is weighed down by guys that are just not either not contributing because they're injured or are contributing really poorly because they're not who they used to be anymore. And it's just like how you untangle all of those things, especially with, you know, at least one guy who is like a franchise legend, probably the second most beloved player in like the history of the team. Like, I don't know how you deal with all that stuff. Like, I don't envy, you know, Mike Dunleavy Jr. for trying to figure this out.
The additional huge factor that I think has been an underappreciated problem for the Warriors this year, and part of this is that I see so many of their games in person, is that Klay Thompson no longer being viable as an on-ball defender has completely changed the Warriors' defense. Because in part, you can add in Gary Payton being hurt for a lot of the year, but they weren't starting him really anyway. Is that at times they could use Wiggins, at times now they've been using Kuminga. So, like, for example, Kuminga fouled out last night because he was the primary defender on Trae Young, at least late. I didn't watch most of the early part of the game, as I don't usually watch Warriors road games. And so that's a huge problem. So it has to be, because it's not going to be, you don't really want it to be Steph. That's burning the candle at both ends. He's not also particularly great at it. And so it has to be someone else, and you get into all these other problems, and most of the players, especially the ones they have available, who are good at that, aren't doing a lot of other stuff that's going on. And so it's a challenge. And like Klay if he shoots well and, you know, can do all these other things, he can still be a positive player, but his pathway to it is even more narrow than it was before. And like how Clay did it before, it was narrow, but it's like, be one of the best shooters of all time, be a very good defender. And so he did that, and then now they're kind of trying to figure out the other elements of it. And so there are big threads here. And I mean, it's financial, it's personal, it's how do you resolve a dynasty in a way that satisfies everyone? And, you know, like the Draymond general, the contract structure, I think that satsatisfied it. But then he's, of course, had his issues this year. And I don't know. I don't know that things with Clay will work out the same. And the way that they possibly could is if Clay, you know, let's say he makes a big demand of the Warriors. They're not saying he will, but let's say he does. And then they go, well, just see if you can find it somewhere else on the market. And if you can find it, then we'll consider giving it to you. And then he just can't. And then that kind of squares up some of the financial stuff. Like, I had this theory that there's a possibility, not saying a probability or anything like that, that the Warriors are out of the tax entirely next year. And can do that without necessarily sacrificing that much in team quality. They have really missed Chris Paul when he's been out with his broken hand. But they could, you know, they could piece a couple of things together. If you get a capable backup point guard with the mid-level exception, for example, you could do some things there, or a buy it. Like, and theoretically, if they shed enough salary in Chris Paul, and if Clay, whether it's he's gone or he takes a severe discount, that you could actually get the buyout, the big buyout guys, they could maybe get something interesting there. But yeah, it is a lot to take in for them. And then for the Bulls, I think that in many ways it is an acceptance of reality, I guess, is probably the way that I would describe it. And I mean, there has not been an acceptance of reality overall there. I mean, the Vucevic technically extension, even though it was signed right before things started, or the, you know, like the murmurs about what's going on with what they're kind of thinking with Caruso and everything else. It's like, yeah, it's pretty logical that what they should do is trade the things that aren't nailed down and build a new vision, even if it's going to take 3-4 years for them to be relevant again. But I am exceedingly skeptical that that's going to be what happens, but I'd be thrilled to be wrong.
Yeah, I thought Nate brought up a good point related to Caruso on the mock deadline, where he's like, this guy's 30 and seemingly can't play more than like 25 minutes a night. And if he loses like 5% on defense, all of a sudden he has like no value around the league. So you should try to get what you can now and not insist on like 4 first-round picks for this guy. But that also requires the Bulls to show like a level of awareness of where they stand in the hierarchy of the league and whether there's any realistic possibility of that changing anytime soon. And that's just not something we've seen from them, you know, in either in recent years or in not so recent years, going back to, you know, like the early 2000s. But with Golden State, I think the issue for me is that they finally found their two timelines, guys, but it seems like it may have come like a year or two too late, because Kerr wasn't willing to trust Kuminga and especially Moody to play through mistakes over the last couple of years in a way that let him pop early enough and earn Kerr's trust, so that he could have been, you know, an integral player for them before the last like 2 weeks, when he's been absolutely destroying things on both ends of the floor. Like, imagine if they were getting this Kuminga in the starting lineup the entire year instead of running whatever Wiggins was out there early in the season, you know, like, and just those guys sort of popped too late comparatively to, you know, where Wiggins has been this season and where Clay has been this season. And then, you know, all of it has happened pretty much like since Chris broke his hand. Like, you know, even Podziemski sort of emerged mostly after that, even though he had been playing in some lineups with Chris Paul. And then like Jackson Davis played really well for a stretch, and now all of a sudden he's like not playing again. Like, the way they've handled their younger guys and sort of like not let them play through mistakes has sort of undermined their own idea of what this, you know, whole two timelines thing was going to be. Like, those guys, I think to a lesser extent with Podziemski and Jackson Davis, because they're rookies, but like they should have known what they had in Kuminga and Moody coming into this season, and they didn't, because they wouldn't play them over these last couple of years.
A couple of different things that are worth dwelling on for a second. So one of them is, it's been really jarring over the last couple of weeks to see how much the Warriors needed this boost of athleticism. Like, they have a deeply unathletic team over the last few years. And they were never, like, Steph and Klay were never beasts in that way. And Draymond, you know, that isn't what, but they usually surrounded them. You could think about, you know, Iguodala's taper off in that respect. And they, you would usually have one or two other guys, like Gary Payton, who would fly around and could do this stuff. Wiggins, of course, when he was available, or in the earlier days, HB and various different guys. That's been huge. The other thing, and I don't know that this is fair, but I also think it's worth saying. I've said this to people on Press Row a lot this year. It feels to me like Steve Kerr has a patience for some kinds of young guy mistakes and not for others. And so it seems to me like he has had significantly more understanding with the mistakes that Brandon Pajemski makes. Like, sometimes he, like, goes for a steal and it's not quite there, or he'll, you know, he'll, like, they're kind of, they're sins of, like, over aggression sometimes. Like, he's trying something and all that, but he's not usually taking bad shots. He's not, you know, like, generating bad possessions necessarily in that sense. And so it seems like it doesn't trigger Steve Kerr's sensibilities in the way that Kuminga and Moody did for a long time. And Moody, like, for me, it was always flashes with him rather than the possession by possession. Like, he was never the defensive player I wanted him to be. I mean, I loved his film going back to when he was in college. And with Kuminga, I mean, yes, he does appear to be a better player now than he was 2 years ago. But there was a complete lack of patience for those kinds of miscues. And what has to be frustrating for Warriors fans about that is, as you said, having more patience for those then would have theoretically led to a reduction in them now.
Yeah, and also would have led to a reduction in their reliance on guys like Klay and Wiggins, because these guys would have been ready from the jump and they would have known they could count on them from the jump. And I think especially with Kuminga, like you said, Moody was more flashes and, like, every once in a while, and, like, in the games where all the other guys were out and things like that. Kuminga, I think we saw, even when he was a rookie, how badly they needed that athleticism that you mentioned earlier. Like, even 2 years ago, and like, obviously, you know, they won the title, so it doesn't really matter in the interim. But, like, you could see how much he got them going in the open court, and how, like, he gave them sort of a rim runner type of guy when he was allowed to play like that, that they didn't really have in their other incarnations. And just the way he's defended, I think, in these last couple weeks, like, they haven't had that since Wiggins in the finals, you know? Like, even when Gary Payton's been healthy, because Kuminga is so much bigger, it's, like, a totally different thing.
It is, and it's made a world of difference for them. In the remaining time that we have before we part ways, I want to throw out a couple different teams for you, and I think just kind of work through it a little bit. And so I don't think of them as that compelling, but so there's this group of teams in the East that are below 500, but not, like, catastrophically, other than if we're counting the Raptors there at this point, because they're now, I think, 14 under. But the Bulls, we already talked about, the Hawks, the Nets, the Raptors, and for them, it's not only what are we, where are we going, but what is the difference between those two approaches? So, like, I don't think anyone expects the Hawks or the Raptors to be buyers. There's been some reporting that the Nets might be. But there's a difference between holding pat and selling and aggressively selling. And some of that will be dependent on the offers you receive. And it should be. Like, that's the way it works. But there are still plenty of benefits to weighing those approaches.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Hawks, obviously, there's been a lot around DeJounte Murray, although there has been some recently of, like, maybe they might not be quite as willing to deal him, and maybe they think they could get more in the summer, or maybe they don't want to deal him at all. Like, who knows with the Hawks? But they've got, you know, their cadre of relatively disappointing non-Jalen Johnson wings, basically, that they could deal from, too. You know, guys like AJ Griffin or Sadiq Bey or DeAndre Hunter. There's a bunch of different things they could do there, or Clint Capella and you know, make Onyeka Okongwu the starting center. Like, there are so many different paths they can pursue, but it also gets much less complicated for them to do that in the offseason than it is now, just because it's just way easier to make trades when you don't have to worry about roster spots and salary caps quite as much. You know, the Nets, I understand that it's hard to admit that the team isn't as good as what you thought it was going to be, but they've got guys that could help teams that are pretty far ahead of them, and that they seem like they should at least be able to get, like, you should be able to get, like, multiple seconds for Royce O'Neal, or a first, or a protected first, or whatever, for Dorian Finney-Smith. Like, they should be willing to, like, how much do they want to pay Nick Claxton this summer? And, like, if they don't want to do that, is there a team out there that's going to be a buyer for him? Like, you know, like the Raptors were for Poeltl last deadline, you know, like, it's there's a bunch of interesting directions they can go. And then Toronto, I mean, like, they should just be trying to find takers for Gary Trent and Dennis Schroeder, right? Like, what else are they doing there?
Especially with Trent, because he's an expiring contract, and I wouldn't be too excited about giving Trent his next contract as the Raptors, especially with the flexibility that they have. Flexibility doesn't always bear fruit, but it can. And with Schroeder, you listen, you see what is out there, but he also could generate some interest with him, and it's interesting I've brought up the idea of, like, that he could especially be good for the Lakers if they end up trading D'Lo in a deal. But you could argue that, you know, getting, you know, the person they would trade D'Lo for would probably be involved there. But yeah, I think that you're broadly right. And the complication for the Raps, which I'm going to start keying in on a little bit more, is you brought up the kind of the Poeltl situation, is their pick is top six protected from the Poeltl trade. And it's, you're never going to get it because of how bad the bottom is. You're not going to get into the four best lottery odds. There's a none chance. Like, I would say the Raptors right now, they've won 17 games. I don't think any of the four worst teams in the league, I'm not sure any of them are getting to 17. But this is just, I'm going to actually do the full math on this at some point. If the Raptors end up with the fifth or sixth worst record in the league, they have a better than 50% chance, I believe, of keeping that pick. And yes, there is the potential embarrassment of giving the seventh or eighth pick to the Spurs, but that's a pretty big benefit to me. And I think this has been important to me. I watched the game where they got crushed by the Rockets, which was interesting, where they can, I think they, if Masai is comfortable with it, they, and Darko Rajakovic to an extent, I had Eric Karina on last week, they can still evaluate the fit of Quickley and Barnes and all this stuff, and they can still lose a bunch of games. Like, this is not a team as currently constructed where we'll see with Poeltl being back necessarily, where their best is going to, like, keep them out of that, like, worst of everyone else group.
Yeah, and with Quickley and Barrett back now too, they both missed a bunch of time.
Exactly.
They are sixth in worst record right now, and if they stayed there, it's like a 54% chance that they would lose the pick, that they would land at 54 plus 8, 62. There's like a 63% chance that they would lose it if they stayed with the sixth worst record, because they could then land 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Granted, only a 0.1% chance at 10. But if you move up to, or down, up, I don't know, to the fifth worst record, then there's only like a,
31. It's like 35.
Yeah, there's only like a 42% chance that you keep it. So it would be like, that seems wrong. I might be doing some bad math here. Yeah, so there would be like a 50-something percent chance that they would keep the pick. Like, low 40s percent chance that they would keep it, as opposed to like mid-30s. This is good radio, you know, like me trying to do math live on air.
It is, but I appreciate it all the same. And I'm, yeah, and so for me, like, there's a lot of talk of, like, oh, there aren't that many sellers, there aren't that many buyers. But for me, it's that group of teams of, like, really, what are they trying to do? And then we brought this up with the Knicks in terms of, like, the different kind of backup ball handlers that they could get with Malcolm Brogdon and potentially D'Lo and everything else, is for some of these players and situations, there are multiple options. And so if one of these teams wants to be a hardliner for whatever reason, and you could think about the forward derby, I wrote about the forward carousel also, with, not that they're the same type of players, but like Kuzma and Grant and a few others, where some teams are going to make moves because they need to. Some teams are going to hold on to players because they think that's best. And so I think that one of the challenges is going to be, how much does it take for these teams that can hold on to their guys, Grant is probably the best example of this, to actually get them interested? And if they're holding firm, if they would rather just see how the rest of the year plays out and do something in June, then the supply just gets narrowed and it might just be too hard to get a deal done.
Yeah, that makes it like it only takes, you know, there's the... It only takes one team to make you an offer that makes like your life good enough for you to make the deal, but it also only takes a guy being willing to say like, no, I'm not doing it, and then all of a sudden the guys you want are not available, you know, like, and it's, you can't make a trade without someone willing to trade with you. This is something that I've talked about with friends all the time, where like I remember a couple of years ago, before they wound up signing Jalen Brunson, I had friends who were annoyed that the Knicks didn't trade up to go get Jaden Ivey, and I was like, well, you know, Detroit has to like want what they're offering for right. them to go up and get this guy. Like, you can't just do it because you want to. So, like, you know, the Knicks want like a backup ball handler. You know, the Timberwolves want a backup point guard. Like, somebody has to be willing to trade you the thing that you want in exchange for a value that you find agreeable. And given the identity of the teams that are in position to be the sellers of the type of players that the buying teams want, I do think there's a distinct possibility that like not as much gets done as teams want to get done, because it's hard to deal with certain teams in certain situations.
Especially when kicking the can down the road is a viable choice. And mm-hmm. there aren't that many circumstances this year where teams have to make moves. And I give the Raptors credit for moving, whether they felt they had to or not. We'll never quite know. But the Bulls might not, you know, we could see other teams in that circumstance. And so that presents its own challenges. It's going to be a very important deadline, not necessarily because of the moves that get made, but partially for the moves that don't, and how those age. Like, I've brought this up with various different players where it's like the path of the status quo is risky too in some of these circumstances, especially in some ways if you are a bad team. Where like, I don't think that Kyle Kuzma is going to increase his value significantly, other than his contract looking better, over the next 6 months, because the Wizards are objectively terrible. And so, and it's not like he fits in like a glove on this team or anything like that. So I wonder which of these, sort of like we talked about with the Raptors last year, which of these teams will regret not making a move. I think that's going to, in time, be the bigger story than the moves that do get made.
You mean perhaps like the Bulls and DeMar DeRozan?
Correct. You know, or Caruso.
Yeah, or Caruso. Like, yeah. At least Caruso, I think, has what, one more year after this?
He has one more year at a very team-friendly number.
Yeah, but DeMar's expiring, right? Like,
correct.
And he's not, like, why would he stick around there? There's going to be teams that are going to be interested in him, even, you know, even if it's just for, like, a year or two, to be like, yeah, you can be, you know, our second, third guy, whatever it is. Like, he's still good, you know? Like,
exactly.
And obviously the Bulls are very much not, so.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, but that's the way it goes with some certain teams, you know?
It absolutely is, and I will thank you so much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me, man. It's always a good time.
Bob, thanks again to Jared Dubin for coming on. You can read his excellent work at Last Nine Basketball, which, conveniently, lastninebasketball.com is the URL there, and so much great stuff. I'm so happy I'm a subscriber. Both Jared does great text, you know, analysis, but also great video work, which I'm jealous of because I am terrible at everything involving video, and he is very, very good. You can also follow him on Blue Sky, JADUBIN, number 5, .BSKY.social. And as I said, love having him on, and we will know a lot more about kind of the rest of the season and everything after the trade deadline, though my instinct is a lot of the biggest moves have already happened, you know, the Ananobi and Siakam deal, but I've been wrong before. I'll be wrong again. And, you know, it's more fun if more things happen. So we will have to see. If you want to support Real GM Radio, there are a lot of things you can do. You can subscribe and download the podcast in whatever podcast player you use. And if our show is not in a player that you would like it to be in, please let me know. And I will pass that up the chain to people who can actually solve that problem, which is not me. I don't have the technical expertise. You can also help other people find the show by leaving a rating and review in that podcast player, or word of mouth, or social media. All of those things are greatly appreciated. But the most important thing you can do for Real GM Radio or any other show that has them is to check out our sponsors. For us, FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins. And plenty of things that you can wager on with the Super Bowl coming up. It's lots of fun. And of course, as a Niners fan, I am very invested in that 1 week from today as I'm recording this. If you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I try to reply. I'm not the greatest at replying. I acknowledge that right now, but that is what it is. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.